So without further ado, let me welcome Governor Andrew Cuomo, who is the hero of a gigantic parade in New York City yesterday and is getting generally plaudits for his first 6 months in office, to the show. Top of the morning, Governor. How you doing?
Top of the morning, Frederick. How you doing?
Good. I beat you to it.
You did.
Boy, you must be feeling terrifically when you look over the papers. I'm looking at Bob Ward. He's from the Rockefeller Institute. Less than 6 months in office, Governor Cuomo has driven a trifecta of historic policy changes. And I look at my own writing. He only gave you a trifecta. You may have seen that I gave you a grand slam. I wrote, Cuomo's first 6 months in office have, in fact, been nothing short of a grand slam of remarkable successes, a revolutionary redefinition of marriage, closing a $10 billion budget deficit without new taxes, a game-changing local property tax cap, and sweeping ethics reform. How do you see your first 6 months?
I'll tell you, Fred. First of all, you mentioned before the parade. That parade yesterday was unlike anything I've ever participated in, and it's even hard to describe. We talk about the difference that government can make in people's lives and the trajectory of the state. But this issue of marriage equality has touched people in a way government seldom does. It's personal. It's who they are. It's who their family is. And the outpouring of just genuine emotion, the tears, the jubilation, it was amazing. I tell you, it really was amazing.
I think it's very unique. But, of course, you do know that there are plenty of other people who are not happy about this. You were in a community that was thrilled about this, a community that has been historically discriminated against and vilified. So, needless to say, it's of great significance to them. But I assume you're also sensitive to those people who find this quite unsettling.
I totally am. And I get it. And look, change, and we've talked about this all along, change is hard. I think part of this is generational. And for older people, such as myself, this is dramatic change. Younger people, by the way, get this much easier than I think older people do. So I understand it. I understand the sensitivity. I understand the religious sensitivity. And that's why we worked very hard. Some criticized us for working too hard on balancing the religious freedom and the marriage equality. And I think the statute does that. But it's profound for people. I mean, I have parents of gay children who say, you know, this makes me more comfortable with the fact that my child is gay because society has accepted them. And that's what it really is. It's acceptance. It's respect. It is equality. It is the second word. I said this in the Red Room. It's marriage equality. It's the second word. Equality. Recognize me for who I am. All, you know, people gay feel that they've been looked down on, treated differently all their lives, and this was equality. And it's really, I've been in and around government a long time, as you know, Fred. I've never seen or felt anything like this. And it works on so many levels.
Yeah.
You know, this is New York state government again leading the way. We talked about this back in January, how this state was the beacon. This state was the leader. And we did that again. We reestablished the role of the state government, and they're not laughing at Albany. We talked in January how Albany had become a punchline for national comedians. And now they're talking about the great progressive work that New York did again. So,
I want to talk to you about some of that work, but since you just talked about the nation talking about New York again, let me get to something that I was going to ask you about later, but I'll ask you about it now, and that's something that you certainly saw over the weekend pop up. I have a Bob Shrum column on my screen here. Let me see if I can call it up, a well-known national Democratic consultant. There are plenty others out there. Shrum wrote on a column headlined, President Cuomo, the bold New York governor who brought same-sex marriage to the Empire State, has become a civil rights hero and a 2016 contender. If you're old enough, you may find a use for those Cuomo for President buttons from the 80s and 90s that you threw in the back drawer way back when. That is assuming they only flaunt a last name, Mario, who would have won, declined to run. But there is this talk out there. I saw Maggie Haberman and a colleague write about it in Politico. I have something in the Post today saying you're trying to knock this down, or your people are. What about this flurry of discussions of a Cuomo presidency in 2016?
Well, look, obviously 2016, it's silly. But I think it, what it's really saying, Fred, is that's how profound an accomplishment this is. That's what they're saying. What we did on marriage equality, it has such an effect nationwide, that it's driving this kind of speculation. But it's, it, again, it comes back to the impact of what the state legislature did in Albany when they passed marriage equality. That's what this is really about.
It's interesting to me that marriage equality is getting the massive attention it is, and I understand why. I think some of the drama, though, that wasn't there for, say, the property tax cap, had to do with the fact that the cap was pretty much of a done deal, but down to the end Friday night, it was still uncertain if marriage equality, gay marriage, would be legalized. But in addition, it's an international issue. So this is a transcendent issue. Plenty of states have tax caps. But to have the legislature and a governor of a state the size of New York favor same-sex marriage in this way really is unprecedented, because most of the other states that have it now are either tiny states or, more likely, as in Massachusetts, states where it was the courts that imposed same-sex marriage, not the elected representatives of the people.
There's no doubt about that. No doubt about that. And I was talking this morning to my team about scheduling the bill signings, because in some ways what's happened is marriage equality has gotten so much attention, Fred. People aren't noticing the good work that the legislature did on the rest of the agenda. Property tax cap in and of itself, finally, they've been talking about that since the 1970s, 80s, Massachusetts had it, 1995, the Assembly first proposed it, and now we finally get it. So the property tax cap and doing bill signings so that homeowners understand that that happened, and I want them to enjoy it, and I want them to feel it, and I want them to feel confident that we did hear them. I want businesses to understand that we did the tax cap, because it's a very important economic development issue. The rent laws here in New York City, the Article 10 siding law, which, Fred,
knows what that is.
I know, but if the
but tell them. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's very important.
And how many years did we talk about this Article 10 in the back and the forth, and we could never get it? So
That would allow a more rapid siting of power plants, should we ever be able to build one in New York.
So that whole thrust of the session, you know, that has to be communicated, because it was a powerful, powerful session for the people on almost every level.
By the way, just one last thing on that earlier question dealing with the presidency. Where do you stand on the possibility that you might run in 2016?
If we get 26, we have an election next year.
No, I know, but is it a possibility?
No, it's not a possibility.
It isn't?
Yes, it's
you're a Sherman-esque statement this early? Why would you do that?
It's not about 2016. It's about the power of the passage of marriage.
No, I understand that. But it also, it may be about a property tax cap. It may also be about an ethics reform. It may be about an Article 10. It may be about a politician who can get things done and work with opposite members of, or opposite party members, and have a, what commentators are saying, and I agree with this, one of the most extraordinary freshman legislative session for a freshman governor ever, certainly in modern times. I mean, why wouldn't those things go to someone's fitness for the state's, for the nation's highest office?
Yeah, it is. We've both been around long enough to understand what generates the political speculation. And I get it. But I want to focus on the real issues and how we can actually, what really happened, and how we can use the accomplishments to grow this state.
You know, I have to warn you of something, in all seriousness. I just got an instant message on my screen, okay, from Greg Birnbaum, senior editor of Politico. It says, first he wrote, let's hear more on 2016. Then he said, he's ruling out running. That's a wood for Politico. He's all, and I'm not kidding you, it's right on my screen right now, and he's listening. He's all juiced up. He thinks you ruled out running in 2016. Is that true?
No.
Let's be clear.
I'm not going to engage in this conversation. I'm not going to engage or fuel the speculation. I have a very important job to do. We just started doing it, and I'm going to focus on this job.
Fair enough.
This was a great legislative session. And, by the way,
is there anything left for you to do in the next 3.5 years?
Look, we have to do it. We have a lot of
work. I got some ideas.
We have organizational work with the state government. We have economic development work to do, especially in upstate New York. We have a ton of work to do. Also, we just started, I think, the progress that we're going to make with this legislature. You know, Fred, the legislature in Albany has been maligned for many, many years. I started out by saying to them in January, I don't know if you remember in the State of the State, I said, look, this is part redeeming the legacy of the New York State Legislature. And we didn't have a perfect session, of course, but it's not about perfection in life. They did a magnificent job at the end of the day.
There's no question about it. Of course, it took leadership. It took maybe some of the objective conditions out there, the deteriorating upstate economy, as we certainly well know, the scandals that laid the foundation for some of the ethics reform. But nevertheless, it takes a leader to deliver these things. And I think the overwhelming consensus is, if not unanimity, it may in fact be unanimity, is that you provided that leadership. Governor, I have my ex-colleague here, Brendan Scott, sitting next to me. You know, he's heading for Hong Kong. And he handed me a question that he wanted me to ask you. It's a very legitimate question. You know, he's a serious journalist. And I thought, since he's sitting right next to me, if you didn't mind, we might give him a kind of a parting thrill to ask it himself, and you could say a few words to him. Is that okay with you?
Please.
Okay, Brendan, go ahead.
Hi, Governor. Can you hear me?
Hey, Brendan.
Hey, how are you? I was just wondering how you felt in the wake of the marriage vote about some of the threats about, as a practicing Catholic, to be removed from the church or be denied communion or anything like that as a result. How do you feel about that? I know there's some debate about in the church about whether communion should be used as a weapon.
Well, Brendan, this is an issue that I've been exposed to all my professional life, one way or the other. You weren't around during the days of my father, but he was dealing with issues like the death penalty and a woman's right to choose.
And the abortion battle, sure.
Yeah, the abortion battle. And it's the tension, if you will, the dynamic between the religious community, religious ordinances, and the legal pressures as governor. You know, it goes back to early times where you had people who were torn between their personal religious beliefs and their professional obligations. So it's nothing new. I think I understand the church's position on this issue, not just the church, by the way, many, many religious organizations. I understand it. I'm a Catholic, as you know. My Catholicism is important to me. But I'm not, as governor, you're there to enforce the law and interpret the law. And they are two very different roles in two different positions. But it's unfortunate, but I understand it. I also think it was handled well in this situation. I think people expressed their opinions, members of the church expressed their opinions, and we agreed to disagree, and we went forward. And I think everybody made their point of view clear, but it didn't become hostile or counterproductive, and I'm pleased with that. I'm not pleased with your leaving, Brendan. I'll tell you the truth. Now that you are, he's officially gone, right, Fred?
Yep, sadly.
Now that you're officially gone and you don't have the pen in your hand anymore.
Always have the pen in my hand. That's the way it's. It's a life calling.
I'm sad to see you go because you are a very talented, relatively young person, and we don't have enough talented young people coming into Albany. We haven't attracted enough. As a matter of fact, we've lost probably two generations of young people. When I was your age, Albany was the place to be. You know, it was one of the leading state governments in the country. And you went there because maybe it wasn't Washington, but after the national government, Albany was one of the best. We lost that, I'll tell you the truth. And to see you leaving, although it has there are different circumstances, but you and Aaron Billups, hopefully when we really have Albany up and running the way it should be, you guys are going to come back because you're going to miss the place and the energy and the news that's coming out of Albany. I
was going to say, I won't make any comments about Aaron Billups heading to Washington, D.C., and Brendan is thinking down the road that maybe someday he'd want to work there. Who knows what kind of a reunion might take place one day.
Right, well, anything's possible.
also the way I choose to interpret this, Fred, is they're both leaving for personal as opposed to professional reasons.
Well, that was certainly a major contributing
yes.
factor. There's no question about it.
And I want to see the contributing factors rather than the lack of accomplishment.
Well, I'd make the argument that Albany over the next 4 years or so, 5 years, could be more exciting than what's going on in Washington, notwithstanding the fact that, of course, amazing and very, very important issues are being addressed in Washington almost every day.
I think that's right. I think, and look, it was that way for many, many years. You know, state guy was in Washington, as you know, for 8 years. State governments are faster. They are the laboratories of democracy. They can get things done faster. They can see the effect of their policies
sure.
sooner than you can in Washington. So they are often more exciting, more productive units. And this session showed that we can recapture part of that magic.
Yeah. Governor, let me ask you about a few things that are pending out there that a lot of workers, I think state workers and state citizens, have concerns about. You have to make a decision soon on the Public Employees Federation and the possibility of large numbers of layoffs because PEF, unlike CSEA, hasn't at least tentatively approved the contract with the state. Do you expect to get a PEF contract before those layoffs come due?
It's up to PEF. Fred,
How close are you to knowing what the PEF is going to do?
As close as PEF, it's all up to PEF. Talk to PEF. I think the reasonableness of our position, the reasonableness of our offer has been demonstrated with the CSEA acceptance. So you'd have to ask PEF what they're thinking. PEF what they're thinking and what. They're free to do whatever they want to do, but it's up to them.
This legislature delegated to you, of course, the authority to shut down up to 6 prisons, and that was expected to be done, I think, right after the budget. It never happened. When will the public learn of your decision on which prisons will be closed? Because that affects a great many people, of course.
Literally the next week or so.
Okay. Probably this week, do you think, or more likely early next week?
I don't know. It'll either be, but it's within the next, let's say, 10 days or so. We were a little busy the past few weeks, and the legislature is now obviously out of session, so we can turn to some more organizational
yeah.
matters, and this is at the top of the list.
Now, I think this Friday is the date that the Department of Environmental Conservation is supposed to present to you a much-anticipated, very important report on whether or not it's feasible to drill for natural gas in the Marcellus Shale area of the Southern Tier, with the potential of billions of dollars in revenues for local people, for the state government and others. How soon after you get the report, assuming you do get it on July 1, do you expect to make it public, number one? And two, a comment yourself about whether or not what steps you're going to take to either allow drilling to take place or to prevent it.
As soon as they are ready, Fred, I will be briefed, and right after I'm briefed, it will be released to the public, and I'll tell you what I think after the briefing.
So you think after the briefing you will make a comment on whether or not the state should go ahead with drilling or trying to stop it, or is there going to be a period of weeks that you're going to want to consider it?
Well, first let me get the briefing from on the report and see what it says. But as soon as I get the briefing, I'll tell you what I think.
Are you leaning in one direction or another right now? As you well know, this is a very emotional issue with a lot of activist types.
No, I've heard a lot about it from all sides. You know, during the campaign, it was a very big issue, as you know. And I sat down and talked to all sorts of groups on this for many, many months. So I have a sense of the facts. I have a sense of the energy behind it, pardon the pun, on both sides. And as soon as I get the briefing, I'm ready to talk about it.
Fair enough. Let me ask you something, if I could, about these 4 Republicans who broke ranks from where they had been in 2009, although one of them wasn't in the Senate then, so 3 of them broke ranks. There's a lot of speculation on what, if anything, you did to convince Roy McDonald and Mark Grisanti, Jim Alesi, and Steve Saland to switch their positions on same-sex marriage. Some have suggested there were deals made, promises of endorsements, or money. Any direct deal could be illegal, as you certainly well know, if you offer an inducement to someone to change their vote. But what about that? I mean, my sense, just quickly, is that in each case there was a different explanation. Certainly, I think in Steve Saland's case, and maybe Roy McDonald's case, it seemed to me that there were really personal issues involved. I think in Senator Alesi's case, there may have been some cold political assessments because he's in trouble in his district. But if you could talk to that, what was done to convince these people or help convince them to switch their positions?
You know, first, to Dean Skelos, I give him credit for letting the vote be taken and for not imposing a partisan party position on people. He said from day one that it was a vote of conscience and he was going to let his members vote. And he did. He didn't have to. They could have come up with some excuse why they couldn't vote. Now, I believe, by the way, if they had tried to do that, it would have been a true mistake. But he let his conference vote, and the best I can determine, he didn't try to influence anyone's vote. And credit to him on that. On the four, I think they were all different, Fred. And my conversations would be, you know, tell me what you're thinking. Tell me what you're feeling. And they were all different. And your thumbnail is basically right. Senator McDonald, I think he just thought this was the right thing to do. And he was at a point in his life where it was important for him to do the right thing. And he knew he was going to take political grief, and he was going to do it anyway, period. And he was more informing me than anything else.
Right.
And he was talking to me because this is where he was going to be, but he understood that it was part of a larger effort, and he wanted to do it in a constructive, productive way, and how could he be helpful? But I didn't convince Senator McDonald in any way to do this. Hmm.
There were no deals made, offers made, or suggestions of political support?
No, of course not. Right. Of course not. And he, I tell you, it was a really, I was inspired by him. Senator Saland is a tremendously thoughtful, deep thinker. He was troubled by the question of religious organizations. We spent hours and hours and hours, Fred, working on the language and drafting those religious provisions and going back and forth. And there was a group of three senators, and then they would go to the conference. And we talked it through. He's a very intellectual fellow, deliberative fellow. And there were political consequences. But again, he was there. He wanted to do the right thing, and he was struggling with what was the right thing. Each one was different.
I think Michael Barbaro, writing in the New York Times, has done a very good job in explaining some of what went on there and recounting some of the back and forth. It's some very solid reporting. But I was surprised today the New York Times, in an editorial, said that that language you worked on with Senator Saland and others was totally unnecessary, that the Constitution provides, I guess the state and federal constitutions, provide sufficient protections for, to religious organizations to avoid problems. What did you make of the Times' claim? And I know you had said that you thought these extra protections, of course, were needed.
Yeah, well, I think it was nice that they offered their opinion on what religious organizations should have felt.
Well, they have a deep commitment to religious people and, you know, the belief in God, I'm sure.
Yeah, so that was nice that they offered their opinion. And I'll go to the religious organizations when I want an opinion about the First Amendment and when government is intruding on journalists. But it was a real concern. It was a real concern. And look, this whole debate and discussion by the religious organizations, part of it was they disagreed. And second, if it was going to happen, then they wanted comfort that it was not going to be imposed on them, or they were not going to be penalized if they didn't participate by government.
Do you think some, like Senator Greg Ball, who seemed to go like a bouncing ball in both ways until the end when he said he wasn't going to vote for the bill, were looking to use this demand for stronger and stronger language protections for religious groups as cover when they didn't get it so they can claim they could claim that that was the reason they weren't voting for it?
Yeah, I don't want to comment on Ball. I don't know the man. But I have no doubt that, look, sometimes a tough issue like this, politicians seek cover, and in this situation where they had to say yes or no, because the first cover is don't take a position, right? The old adage: a legislator who does nothing wrong. So if you get
isn't inscribed on the walls in some of the legislative offices here at the Capitol?
Yeah,
I won't say over the entrances to the Assembly and Senate.
So you know, they had to take a position. And I think to the extent some of them were using it for quote-unquote cover, I think some of them were genuine. But the issue of religious protection was a real one. For a fellow like Senator Saland, Senator Lanza and Senator Hannon also, I believe, who were the three who were working on this, they were genuinely concerned that if it passed, these protections should be in place. And I think it's one of the reasons why they were willing to bring it to the floor was that these protections were in place.
Governor, we only have a couple of minutes remaining. Let me ask you this question. Have you had a chance to speak to your father, former Governor Mario Cuomo, about your first 6 months? And if so, what did he think? Can you give us a sense of that?
Yeah, I have. All through it, obviously. I talk to him all the time, as you know. And he's been through this a few times on a few different issues, so his insights are always valuable to me. But he's not there day-to-day, so he has a little distance. And sometimes the coverage and the discussion in the bubble in Albany can be a little disconnected. So from my father's point of view, he always was drawn to these issues of principle for the time, issues that are very important for government to speak to. And he was involved in death penalty for all those years when Brendan was asking about the church issues, the Notre Dame, abortion, choice. That really, in many ways, was the continuous cord through his governorships, if you would think about it, when you think about it, from term to term, Fred. It was always, he was always pushing the edge on questions of principle and that debate.
We just have a minute remaining.
And this is another one in that line of important philosophical, moral issues for society to grapple with.
Did he think you did a good job?
He thinks I was on the right side of the issue, and he thinks we were successful. And I think he would say we did a good job.
Well, that's what everyone is saying. Governor, it's always a pleasure to have you with us and an honor to have a governor on your show. So we thank you so much for joining us this morning and congratulate you on what everyone is saying. It was a terrific legislative session.
Thanks very much, Fred.
Thank you very much for being with us, Governor Andrew Cuomo. This is Fred Dicker live at the State Capitol. My thanks, of course, to the governor and to Brendan Scott, who I'm going to bring back later in the week.